From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. I've often described Badr Benjaloun as the quintessential example of a Renaissance expat, and this was never more obvious than when he opened Suju, Beijing's first, and so far only, Moroccan rum sports bar in one of the city's thousand-year-old hutongs. It was seen by many as a living example of the unique cultural mashup that can only happen when you bring together disparate peoples into a city full of migrants. His migration story, which includes a stint as the blogger of record tracking Beijing's dynamic music scene in the aughts and teens, illustrates how migration enlivens and enriches a place, and how people who come from abroad bring new ideas, perspectives, and cultural ephemera to a city, making it a more vibrant and enjoyable place to live. I really love these conversations. Since I've started doing this show, I've been able to explore issues surrounding migration, as well as questions of identity and how they change. It's always extra special for me when I get to talk about these things with old friends. As I've mentioned before, these just aren't the kinds of things that we normally talk about with folks when we meet for dinner or go out for drinks. Case in point, I met an old friend at a bar last night, and while I was telling him about this podcast and migration media, we got into some of these concepts, and I realized that even in my own life, it's rare that I find myself asking people about their identities as migrants when I'm not talking about this show. It's a tough thing to bring up, but it's super rewarding when you do, and hopefully this show can help more folks to do it. So let's jump right into this week's conversation. Please sit back and relax and enjoy my talk with Badr Benjaloun. Badr Benjaloun, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thanks for having me.
Where is home?
Quote Metallica. Wherever I lay my head is home. Home is Beijing right now.
I'm not surprised you'd quote Metallica. You are a metalhead.
It's a good song. It's wherever I may roam, where I lay my head is home.
Right.
I've been hearing that piece of lyrics since before I started living on the road. So
yeah, you've been on the road for quite a while, but now you're in, how long have you been in Beijing for?
In Beijing, going on 13 years. In China, going on 15.
Wow.
I'm about to have my 15-year Chinaversary.
I forget, because I've been here 10 years, and I think I only met you in year two. So, I mean, I equate you with a long-term person, but I, for some reason, it never... I don't think of you as being one of those people who've been here so much longer. There's a category of people that I have in my brain that I know, because you just know those guys, and they've been here for 15, 20 years. And you're in that category, but I don't put you in there. Maybe because we're friends.
I don't even put myself on there. I remember thinking of people that spent 10 years in China as, holy shit, you've been here for 10 years. And then I became one of those. And then I've gone past it. It still sometimes does not register. It's true. When people say time is just a number, it is just a number.
Yeah. Yeah, I you know, we'll talk to people who are newer, they're more, you know, more recent emigres or people who've moved here. And, you know, they'll say, how long have you been here? And I'll be like, oh, 10 and a half years. And they'll go, wow, I only have three. And all I can think in my brain is, I know people have been here 20, 25, like 10 is nothing. And then I forget, I was once that guy who was here for 3 years saying, wow, you've been here for 10 years. And it just, doesn't feel that way.
Well, so the older you get, I heard this week actually, and it makes so much sense. The older you get, the faster time goes by.
Right.
And that's what a friend of mine said. And I was like, why is that? You know, a smart-ass comment like I tend to make. He said, well, because it becomes a smaller percentage of your life.
Right. It's math.
It's pure math. 5 years when you're 20.
Right.
It's 25% of your life. 5 years when you're 40, now you're talking at like 12, 13%.
Yeah.
It's a different perspective
on
things.
Yeah, the way I thought about it when I hit my 10-year Chinaversary was that I had lived in China for just as long as I lived outside my mom's house when I was back in Boston. So I moved out of my mom's place, and then I was on my own, quote, for 10 years. And then I moved to China, and I've been here for 10 years. And now I'm past that. It's just weird to think about it that way. So where did you get your start? Where are you from originally?
I'm from Casablanca, Morocco. So that would still be the geographical home according to my passport.
It's very romantic.
So they say.
Anyone who says they're from Casablanca, there's like this image, at least for Americans or Western people, that just, there's just that, it's got a weight behind it, just the name of the city.
Even in Asia, funny enough. But yeah, Casablanca, I mean, I grew up a little bit between Morocco and France. Then in 1996, I left Morocco for what I thought would be just a little while to go to the US and study. 1996, we're in 2019.
Where in the US did you go to?
I started off in Toledo, Ohio.
I didn't know that you were in
Yeah,
Toledo.
freshman year, University of Toledo.
Wow.
One of those bizarre circumstances. But I only lasted 1 year in Toledo. It was way too freaking cold.
Yeah, I
It
can
was the
imagine.
worst winter that I had in 50 years.
Oh my God.
For a desert blood boy, no good. Then Tallahassee, then moved to Atlanta for a while, then yeah, China happened.
So, well, let's back up for a minute. What was the impetus to go overseas for school, and why the US?
I grew up through international schools with a heavy French influence in the schooling system. Once I got my high school degree, or my baccalaureate as it's called there, I had the IB version of it. Now I wanted to be a chemical engineer, a petrochemical engineer. To do that in the French system is too complicated for a 15 or 16-year-old to make up their mind. You can go to specialized school, you can do specialized math prep school before you go into a university, and then you go into this and this. And I kept looking at the options, and there's the option in a US university going, you go to school for a degree, they make the decisions for you, just follow the program, as opposed to me in my hot-blooded teenage years having to make important decisions that would affect my future life in terms of, oh, do I join the university? Do I go into specialized school? Do I go into engineering program in school? And that was really how the call came about.
Were you looking specifically to go overseas, or is just something that kind of came up?
No, it's a tradition in my family. We all studied overseas.
Oh, really?
So my older brothers, my little brother, my little sister, it's just my parents always believed that you need that time away from home to really be what you are.
It's interesting. So, were your parents, did they spend time overseas?
Yeah, well, growing up, we were always traveling between Morocco and France, mostly because of my dad's job. He was into publishing, so he would take Moroccan books and get them translated and published in France, and vice versa. Books, novels in French, get them translated, edited, and published in North Africa in Arabic.
So you grew up kind of experiencing two cultures. So the
Yes.
idea of going overseas for school in your formative years, that's not a crazy idea.
That was not a crazy idea. It was expected.
So you only lasted 1 year in Toledo, Ohio, you said because of the cold. And then you went to Florida. Were there any other kind of problems besides just the weather that you ran into? I mean, when you're in Florida, obviously there's no more weather excuse, but were there any other issues that you had?
In Toledo or
No, not till in Florida, because I know you went to, what did you go to, UF or
no
FSU?
FSU,
Okay,
come on. No,
sorry,
no, 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 no.
sorry.
Don't get your universities mixed in the state of Florida.
Sorry. I know that's a no-no.
gosh. Nothing really out of this world. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed Tallahassee. It's a small town, but I think it was the perfect town for me to be in. And that's where I blossomed and became part. That's what laid the foundation to the butter you have in front of you now, and that does all of the things he does, for better or for worse.
Yeah. So what brought you to Atlanta?
So basically, when I was in Tallahassee, when I was attending Florida State, I started my own company, an IT company. We were one of the last dot coms, and we rode the tail end of the dot com boom. Beautiful. And when I graduated, most of my customers were in Atlanta already. So it was a natural move to go from Tallahassee to Atlanta with the business.
Now, then you went to New Orleans, am I right?
No, I never actually lived in New Orleans for all the time I've spent in it.
Right.
New Orleans is one of my favorite cities in the world, but it was also a four-hour motorcycle drive from Tallahassee to New Orleans, so I was there almost every weekend. I would get on the bike at 8 p.m. on a Friday, ride, get to New Orleans by midnight, 1 in the morning, park the bike, and... join the party.
So when did the cooking come into it? Because I know you got a you obviously, if you're in New Orleans, you fall in love with the food. I don't think anyone who's ever been there doesn't fall in love with the food. Is that where you got the cooking bug?
No, the cooking. I'm still not sure I have a cooking bug. Growing up, I was the one that was actually not in the kitchen. I was the one listening to music, reading books, doing all kinds of stuff, but never ever in the kitchen. My little brother was always in the kitchen. I was not. The cooking started in Toledo when I got there, and I really missed the flavors from home.
Not a lot of good African food or Moroccan food when you're in Ohio.
Not in Toledo, Ohio. When you're, I mean, Toledo was fantastic for what it was. It was a good stepping stone in the U.S. But I got there in late August 2016. And by mid-September, I was bored of the food on campus because I lived right next to campus. So called my mom. I was like, Mom, I need some recipes. And we spent about 3 to 4 hours on the phone with her describing what I needed to do and how I should cook this, and then start the search to find the utensils to cook Moroccan food and the ingredients. And sure enough, that first experience was failure. That also cost me a lot of money. I mean, think about 4 hours on the phone between Morocco and the U.S.
Oh,
at the
90s.
Time.
Yeah.
That was like $7 or $8 a minute.
I remember I had a, in the late 90s, I actually had a, there was this woman I was dating. She was in, lived in Sacramento, and I was in Boston, and I ran up quite the phone bill. And that's just, I can't imagine living that way again. It's crazy.
Part of it, though, is I miss, like, I remember writing letters and posting them and getting excited when the mail arrived. There was a letter from France or a letter from Morocco. And, like, because we already started using email back then, but not everyone had access to it. And writing letters was still the best way to keep in touch, unless you happen to have a fax machine in your home.
Yeah. Well, it used to mean something bigger. It's still a big deal, but it used to mean something more when you moved overseas because you would be leaving everything behind. But now when you move overseas, you can, as soon as you land, you can whip out your phone and send a text message and that you've arrived. And, you know, there's really there's no distance almost. So let me go back. So you did this, you start cooking because you're desperate for a taste of home. You're desperate for something other than Midwestern American stuff. And this is when you start cooking more. Does this continue when you go down to Florida? That's a bigger college. They must have more culinary options.
There was
better
more
pizza
options. But what happened already in Toledo is I got involved with the international student community, and there was international student food fairs, blah, blah. And now, sidebar note, I was studying chemical engineering at the time.
Oh,
so
wow.
I'm supposedly good with ingredients and chemistry and putting things together.
So why you make good drinks?
So I was asked if I would do Moroccan food for the international student fair. And I said yes without thinking. Then I realized I had to cook for 100 people out of my...
It's your first catering job.
My kitchen, yeah. So, and that's the first time I really had to scale cooking and try and the added pressure of people eating it and me making it. So, going like, shit, I better do this right. And it happened again in Tallahassee. Tallahassee, I really got involved with the international student community. I even ran it for a little while. And that's how one thing led to the other. So, I mean, I started cooking for 100 people before I was cooking for 3 or 4.
Now, one of the things you're known for, and I know you've worked to de-emphasize it of late a little bit, but you're really known for the Cajun influence on your food. That's kind of what you're famous for, at least anyone who knows you for food. you were going to New Orleans every weekend. Is that like, when did you find yourself starting to make Cajun food and incorporate into what you were doing?
In Tallahassee already. And it was easier to find the ingredients and Cajun food.
Is it because it's familiar, because it has French influence?
It's extremely familiar. It's soul food. And it's as close to Mediterranean cuisine as you get in that side of the world.
Yeah, a lot of American.
There's nothing bizarre about it, about cooking it. To me, it feels normal. It's the same way I would cook a Moroccan dish, the same philosophy behind it of slow cooking, of putting spices together and working with whatever ingredients are seasonal.
I've never sat down and talked to you about this before, but now it's actually making so much sense to me because, well, not only your background and where you come from and the French influence, but Cajun food is the only American cuisine. It is the only one we have, which is not a dig on America because we take things from everyone, but it's the only thing that really came from America. And the way you describe it sounds like it's like dishes that migrants would make, which is exactly what it is.
It's dishes that have their roots in Africa.
Yeah. Mixed in with some French and some American.
A gumbo is called a gumbo in parts of Africa.
And really?
It's almost the same dish with a few different spices in it.
Wow. So you hit Ohio, then you hit Florida, then you hit Atlanta. All the while, you've got New Orleans going on in the background. And this is where you're marinating yourself. So after Atlanta, is it then you come straight to China?
Took a little break in Morocco because I had been gone for a while. And then China happened.
China happened. What was the drive to go to China? Why China?
China was an accident. It was never supposed to.
China was an accident.
It's a trip to China that was for reconnaissance and a special project for a week ended up sticking around and changing my life.
It happens. People, they come here and it just, you know, one of the guys I've talked to, Rich Robinson, a few episodes ago, he same thing happened to him. He was like, let me go see what's going on over there. And he just took a train ride, didn't intend to stay, just wanted to see what was happening. And he gets to Beijing, and the next thing he knows, it's 25 years later.
I know. But I think the people, in my experience, that tend to stay the longest are the ones that came with no expectations and were ready to go right away. And then, like, no, let's stay. We like the energy. And for me, that was a big thing about China. It was the energy. 2004 was the lead up to the Olympics. And seriously, without exaggerating, in a city like Tangshan in Hebei, where I was, you'd see a whole building come up in a couple of months. Right. The street completely changed overnight. Things that even to this day no longer happen in the quote-unquote developed world. And I'm a creature that feeds off energy. So I think that's the only real reason why I lasted this long. And I don't see that time go by. It's because there's still that energy.
So what were you doing when you first arrived? You said you were in Hebei. What was the name of the city?
Tangshan.
Tangshan. So how far away from Beijing is that?
At the time, 2-hour bus ride or 7-hour train ride.
Oh, my God.
I was in Tangshan Teachers College trying to work out an exchange program with Florida State and working pretty much as glorified international business and economics teacher.
Nice.
2 days a week.
Nice. It's a nice gig if you can get it.
5 days off in a row. A lot of traveling.
So what would what brought you to Beijing? Did that job end and you just didn't want to go?
I was coming to Beijing basically once a month to stock up on goodies, coffee, cheese, bread.
Yeah, with all the with all the foreign service people and the international corporations have their presences here. So there are stores that have goods for international people.
And in 2004, there was not that many, mind you.
No, it was just a couple.
It was just a couple. So there were still myths about, ooh, you can't find deodorant or black pepper in China, which I still don't know where those myths came out of.
I remember when I first got here, my first Christmas, I was meeting with, it was like a party at one of my friend's place, and I was, I think, the only American there, or there maybe just one other one, but I was desperate to make eggnog. Because I'm from New England and we have eggnog, and I could not find cream. Could not find cream. I couldn't find some other things. I actually had to substitute a lot of things and it's the only time I've ever really made anything where I knew the list of ingredients. Cause I don't cook. I assemble. So I need the ingredients, I need the instructions. And this was the only time I've ever had something where I had the list of ingredients and I knew exactly what I had to do, but none of the, you know, half of the ingredients weren't available. So I had to find something that was like it, and then I had to make it work. And it worked. Like, everyone loved it. It came out really well. But now you walk into the stores, it's just amazing. They got whipped cream. They got all sorts of different kinds, heavy cream, light cream, whipping cream, low-fat cream. I mean, low-fat cream is crazy, but they've got everything. It's a different world. So now, you grew up in a multicultural environment, splitting your time in different countries. You then did your schooling, your formative schooling over in the US, and you played around in probably the most multicultural city in America, just in terms of the native culture, quote, is multicultural, is where it comes from. And then you come over in China, and you're in Tangshan. That's a pretty non-diverse population. Was that a bit of a shock to you to like come and be in a place where it's everyone's like the same? Or because you were in a different place, because it was so different, it felt like being international?
I didn't think about it, to be honest with you. I was there and that was it for me. I was in Tangshan, like, okay, we're seeing something different. And I spent a lot of my time, actually, even though I was living in Tangshan, outside of Tangshan. I developed business relations in Shijiazhuan, so I was there quite often. Then having 5 days off in a row, it was beautiful to travel around China, and the number of trains that I was on, overnighters, just looking at the country and seeing such, because the country is diverse. You take an overnight train and you end up in Suzhou. There you go. It's a whole different world between Hebei and Jiangsu province. And there was more than enough multiculturalism to go around.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because a lot of people in America or in the West, just outside China, don't know how diverse China is. You know, 56 ethnicities, you know, 36 languages and cuisines. It's crazy. You can go from one province to another and it's totally different. The dress is different. The practices are different. But then there's that magical Putonghua Mandarin that most people know.
Most
people. There's plenty that don't. So what ended up bringing you to Beijing permanently? Why did you make the move?
After 2 years in Tangshan, it was time to kind of get back to the real world. And the real world at that point was either going back somewhere else, or we already knew Beijing. And it felt like, okay, the Olympics are right around the corner. Let's go to Beijing and see what Beijing has to offer.
This is about 2006?
This is 2006. And then we'll go after the Olympics.
Okay. Just hang out for a couple more years and then we'll
hang
leave.
Out for a couple more years. Yeah, next year. Next year will be the year.
Yeah, so many people come in here and they'll say, oh yeah, I thought maybe just one or two more years. And then it's just one or two more years. And the next thing you know, the decade is gone. So what were you doing in Beijing when you moved here?
Moved here in March 2016. By then I was mostly moved here, but I was still dealing with all the business I had going on in Shijiazhuan. I was running an intensive Chinese camp where I would take foreigners up the mountain and lock them up for 2 weeks, 6 hours of Chinese a day. I call that Sino camps. And I had a lot of things to deal with until, and then in September, I started working for a Dutch company that handled travel logistics. First as just an operator, and then very quickly within like couple of weeks, I moved to take over the IT department because that's at my specialty. And I got lucky or unlucky that the day I started, there was a major IT emergency. So I ended up having to deal with the IT emergency right away. And like, oh, I think maybe you're more suited to this side of the job.
Now, back in those days, or maybe it happened a little bit after, you were actually blogging quite a lot, especially about the music scene.
It happened a little bit after. I started the blog in around 08, I believe.
It was going when I got here, yep. I remember. So that is kind of where I pick up knowing you. There's more to the story, but one of the things I tell people that I love about living in Beijing is that and this is as a foreigner, I don't know if it's the same in the music scene. I'm assuming it is, but there's such a small community of foreigners, you know, especially the ones who are here for a long time, that you just end up meeting everyone at a certain point, or you're only one degree removed from anyone. Yeah. And everyone who comes here, because it's Beijing, is pretty much at the top of their game, or they're trying to reach the top of the game. You know what I mean? They don't have, you know, everyone who's coming here is either sent here, they've earned their way here, or they're fighting their way here.
Ooh, I would disagree.
You think so?
There's musicians that made it here that would not leave the garage back home.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that? And this, I don't know the music industry. That's, I'm surprised.
Different expectations and different realities. This music scene has venues that provide all the equipment, everything. So bands literally just show up and play. For a long time, it was just side acts until they developed the following. Like, that's what you do. You walk in, the venue's got a drum, a PA, couple of amps. So if you bring in your guitar, your bass, and here you go, you start playing. In a place like the US, or even in a lot of places, in a lot of countries in Europe, smaller venues do not have a dedicated sound system or instruments. You're lucky if they let you come and play. And if they do, you have to bring in your sound system, your amps, your drums, your sound engineer, or bands become better because they have to learn to do sound themselves.
These are all things that you have to be good enough to be able to earn money to get those things or make a big investment in them.
You have to make. The joke was you put $5,000 worth of equipment in a $500 van to drive 50 miles to get paid $50 to play a gig. And that's what happens. That's how the bands earn their keep everywhere else. Here, I still maintain that the bands got a little bit spoiled with that, but also provided so many opportunities that because the scene was open, being able to go anywhere and play anywhere, help them get better, and help them realize whether it's something for them or not. So two sides of the coin, but bottom line is, yeah, a lot of musicians here and to this day where we have actually better musicians, better equipment, would not get out of the garage in other places.
It's interesting.
And a lot of them, I mean, it's also taste and colors, but I'd say it's not a comparison that is valid because of the circumstances surrounding the environment.
It's a different world.
It's a completely different world.
Right. So you were blogging a lot about the music scene, and that's how I first heard of you. That's not how I met you. We met at some parties around town organized by a mutual friend, co-organized by a mutual friend. And eventually that wound down, obviously, because it has to wind down. But while that's all happening, you also got into the food and beverage scene. So you opened, was Suju your first thing that you opened, or was the first one you worked at?
Suju was the first one I opened in China.
Did you ever work in food and bev before?
In the US, got a bit. I had a beer bar in Tallahassee as a side business. I always have my fingers and my hands in 20,000 things. Worked in a steakhouse in Atlanta. You know, when bad months in IT, working at the bar gets you a lot of tips and helps those end of the month.
Okay, so you had some experience. Well, Suju was kind of revolutionary for Beijing because it was this amazing mix. I used to point people to it and I would call it like Beijing in real life. Like it was the embodiment of kind of what Beijing is. It was a Moroccan rum bar in a hutong. And for those who don't know, hutongs are the alleyways in Beijing. If you know, the traditional house in China, in Beijing, I should say, is this four-sided home called a Sichuan. And if you put these four-sided homes and you build them next to each other, they just naturally create these alleyways. So you can walk through these alleyways and there are mazes, like literally in the middle of the city, there are just these mazes of alleys that you can get lost down. And it's quite an amazing experience to walk down these alleyways and stumble into a boutique or, you know, a little coffee shop or a little restaurant that's tiny and has two tables and makes amazing food because the person who's cooking is their family recipe and they're making it in the back. And you opened a place in a hutong and it was small. Like you took over a, was it a Hubei noodle place?
Ningxia noodle place.
Ningxia noodle place. And I love the Ningxia noodles. And you opened up Moroccan rum bar, sports bar. That's what it was. It was a Moroccan food rum specialty sports bar in a hutong. That's just craziness. I mean, I don't know where else I would find anything like that. So what possessed you to get into the food and bev game?
Well, I was already...
In Beijing, for God's sake.
I was already in it, right? So when you get into that bug, you always have it. When I first got to Beijing, there was not as many venues here, as many places. So you got to know the owners, the managers very quickly. And I got to help a few of them with certain things. So even though I did not have my own place, I was doing guest bartending gigs. I was helping them with recipes, with sourcing and training. And I started thinking about actually opening one of my own. And I had no idea what I wanted to open in terms of F&B. But I was like, yeah, I think it's time to have a bar again. And that's how Suju happened. I remember riding around Wanjing and Xuanjing looking for spaces. And then in 2012, it was the Clásico, Real Madrid against Barcelona on a Tuesday at 2 in the morning. And my wife and I, we were not married at the time, were both avid football, soccer fans. So it's like, I want to watch the game. So call around Beijing, check in where we can go watch the game. It's a city of 20 plus million people. There's got to be a place that's open for us at 2 in the morning to watch it. So we called Paddy's at the time. We called a couple of places that would show sports every so often. We called the Goose and Duck, which is now...
I remember that, yeah.
...defunct. And eventually, the only place that said they would be there and we could watch the game was the pool bar on Gulo Dongdajie. The pool bar.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Across from Mao Live. So, and we lived in Suhui, Dong. So,
that's a long way
to
go.
2 in the morning, yeah. We found, well, it's 1 in the morning. We get ourselves a taxi.
There's no Didi. You had to go find a taxi.
To get us all the way to Gulo Dongdajie to watch the game. We walk in. The staff at the bar was surprised to even see us walk in. Like, what are you guys doing there? It's like, oh, we called about the game. It's like, oh, we didn't think you would come. Yeah, we're here now. It's like, shit, we have to show the game. And we sat, watched the game, came down to leave. The staff was all sleeping. So walked out of there. It's like, that's it. Fine. I'm going to open a sports bar. It's impossible to not be able to watch this. And that's how it started.
Right. Now, so you came here. You were doing the kind of teaching thing, the education thing. Then you were doing the tech thing in the capital. Then you're kind of in the music scene. Now you're doing F&B. So while you're doing all this, do you have a sense that you are kind of digging a deeper hole in Beijing? Not in a bad way, but I just mean like you're getting more and more connected as you go. Like if I, so it starts with like coming to the teaching thing. A lot of people do that and they can leave, whatever. Then you get a job with a IT company or a tech company and you're like, okay, I could do this for a while, but I could still leave. Then you're in that music scene. You start really getting to know people. I know you actually made a name for yourself as kind of this independent music journalist. Like you were, people looked to your blog to know what was going on in the scene, kind of at a very high level. And then you're going to drop down a serious investment, not just in money, but in time and a physical space to open up a bar / restaurant. Like, did you have a sense that you were digging a deeper hole in one place? I mean, you've been moved around a lot since, like, up until then, you've always been moving. But now you're kind of really sinking your teeth into a place.
I didn't think about it because none of them were pre-planned. It just, things just kind of happened.
Mm.
The blogging started because I couldn't find, it took me a long time to find the resources about shows and whatnot. So I was like, I've already done the research. Let me copy and paste and publish. That it might help somebody find these shows since I'm already doing all the work. Then it took traction. Actually, the first blogs on Beijing Days, the first blog ever, blog post, was about finding Mountain Dew at a supermarket. It's like, whoa, we got Mountain Dew. And in the early iteration of it, it was mostly about Chinese restaurants, more so than the music. And then the music took over and became a bigger part of it. A nice split the food side to another one called The Noodle Diaries.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Where that was my experiences delving into Chinese cuisine in Beijing and going into the provincial restaurants and whatnot. Suzhou was opened never as a business. The idea was to have my living room where I can watch my sports with my friends. And then eventually it's like, oh, well, I cannot find rums. Let's put some rums in here. No food. And then the Moroccan restaurants closed. Like, butter, you need to put some Moroccan food on the menu. You don't have a place to eat Moroccan. It happened organically, so I didn't have time to think about it. The blogging was fun because it didn't take me that long. I was mostly enjoying the shows, and I never cared about people's opinions. There's still people that think of me as a douchebag in the music world, and deservedly so. And I stopped blogging when I became too grumpy about it.
Oh, you are a total stuck-up snob in the music scene. I recognize it, but I value that. We need stuck-up snobs in the music scene.
Hey, I want musicians to tune their goddamn instruments. If that's a crime, then guilty, Your Honor. So, but going back to it, there was no master plan of doing this. I was still having my full-time job. As my job was subsidizing my hobbies, all of those things were hobbies.
At some point, though, this Suju thing, it's got to take up all your time.
I made sure it didn't. I made sure it didn't. Because I've always said, okay, it's a hobby. I want to make sure it's done well, but there is no pressure.
So I'm drilling down on this because I feel like we've hit the inflection point here. Because up until this point in your life, you've grown up in an international kind of family-minded family. You move around a lot. It's very, I don't want to say carefree, happy-go-lucky, but like you said, you just kind of fall into these things. Like, this is what I want to do. And that's great because your interests are good and you're kind of got your finger on the pulse of culture and society and you're in this path as China's growing and developing and you're right here with it. But then there becomes a point where Suju is not a hobby.
Yep.
And I want to kind of understand what's happening there. Like, is there something that changes within you or does circumstances change and you find yourself rolling with it again?
I've had a few years to think about this one because, yes, it did reach a point where the hobby was no longer a hobby. And that was when I had employees I didn't recognize because I didn't hire them at Suju. And people's livelihoods depended on it, not my own.
Yeah, shit got real.
Shit got real when you go, yeah, I have salaries to pay now. And whether we make money or not, those salaries have to be paid. Now that carefree, let's happy-go-lucky cannot go on. I either keep it as a hobby and go, yeah, we're open when we're open, come and watch some games, have some rum with me, or like to maintain a certain level of quality that I'm proud to have my name attached to, then I needed full-time people to be there and to help handle certain things that I could not handle myself because I was in an office and I had other responsibilities that in my book superseded Suju or the blogging. The blogging and Suju were on my own time. And I was always good about keeping the two separate, not letting them. Even if I got home at 5 a.m, I was in the office and I made sure I got my thing done. So that's like when it hits you and you have to kind of go, oh, let's look at the numbers. Ooh, this was not a good month in revenue, but I still have to pay salaries and rents.
There was a point where Suju was going and it was pretty successful.
More successful than it should have.
Well, I disagree with that. I think it was, like I said, I used to hold it up as the example. I think people were drawn to it because, and this is not shoving sunshine up your butt. I mean, I legit think you fell into, because, you know, like you said, you just kind of, this is what I want. You fell into this thing that just turned out to be the example of when someone thinks of how awesome and quirky and mixed up Beijing is and the big melting pot, you know, of everything. That's what you could point to. That's the example. That's why people were drawn to it. But you then opened a second location, not of Suju. You called it Caravan. And
Caravan is actually the third location.
What was the second one?
Days.
Oh, that's right. I almost forgot about it because it was here and gone so fast. I almost forgot that about it.
Like 3 months.
Yeah. Well, okay. So this is what I mean. So there is a point not only where Suju becomes what you're doing, but then you start to say, okay, I can do more of this. Then you're not just doing the thing. Then you're no longer just investing in the thing that you kind of started to do it for others. And then you're doing it for yourself. But you're also, again, investing in a single place. And I mean the city of Beijing, the community here. So I'm just kind of wondering what made you want to do that.
Over-enthusiasm? I don't know. There's no easy answer to that question. As long as it was happening organically, it was happening organically. Days also just happened like that. I got a phone call from a friend going, hey, I'm too busy with other projects. I cannot run my space. Are you interested in taking it over? It's like, let me see. Yeah, well, the space is already here. It's already running. It's just literally taking it over and tweaking it to my own desires. On the surface, easy commitment, nothing special, just a place also where I tend to hang out, not too far away from the house. Got a bunch of friends that live there, convenient for them to come and hang out with me. Didn't think about the part of commuting between the two and with the full-time job, but it was supposed to be low risk, low social footprint requirements on my own life. And that's how I approached them back in the day. Now, with days, certain things were not meant to happen. Let's just say I did not do my due diligence when I took it over.
That was your learning experience.
It was another learning experience. So, and when I realized what was happening there, that it was not even worth the investment, I walked out pretty much. Like, nah, done. And then it was just Suju. I was happy with Suju. You know, changed jobs to another company. I kept Suju going, just had fun with it. I mean, it lasted for quite some time. So none of those were done open. None of those steps were taken, thinking that I'm laying down roots in Beijing. It was, I am here. And for now, I am here. So I'm just doing what
we're doing. To be clear, everyone who's a foreigner here is always a foreigner, no matter what's going on. You could find yourself gone in a week. Yeah. You know, something could happen. They could pull your permits. I mean, there's always that kind of things have happened. We've all seen it. But in terms of you personally, once you get to Caravan, your third place, that's a serious, like that is a statement.
That was definitely a thought process behind that more as a business.
Yeah.
Suju was opened as a hobby. Days was thought of as like, oh, quick, easy way to make some extra buck cash. By the time we got to Caravan, that's when, just before Caravan, I had quit my full-time job. And the goal was to just take a break. It had been a stressful couple of years leading an amazing team to accomplish things that we did in 2 years that were not done in 10 years. And it took a lot out of me personally. So I decided to take a break. And during that break, get better, do a marathon, done, study some Chinese, and write my book about Chinese noodles. That was the goal. And that's when Caravan happened. Not because I was looking to do Caravan. I was trying to help a friend of mine look for a space to do a business project, an F&B project he wanted to do. And I had the time and space to go around with him. And we stumbled upon that location. Took him, I knew the landlord, so got them chatting, and then all of a sudden my friend looked at me and was like, so how about you take this side and I take this side? Like, hell no, I am not touching it with a 10-foot pole. But as soon as I said that,
The bug was in the brain.
And the bug didn't want to go away.
So since then, how long has Caravan been open now?
4 years.
4 years now. I think it's Suju was 4 years as well, right?
Suju was 2012 until 2017.
Okay. But the last year you were splitting time. That's why. Okay. So you got 4 years in this place now, Caravan, and it's, you know, pretty well known in Beijing. You had the Cajun influence, Moroccan food thing going, and you do live music there. So it's a place where you can have your music buddies and offer, you know, stage time to up and coming people. I would dare say you are a Beijing institution, Botter. So what does that mean to a foreigner to feel like they are such a part of the community? Because forget the bigness of the quality. Like, let's forget that, oh, you're such a good bar person or a good music person. Forget all that. But you've got to have a sense that you have made an investment in this community. You have helped people. People have helped you. There is a very clear fact that you are a presence in the community, but you're also a foreigner. So I'm kind of want to know what that feels like. I could leave tomorrow and no one will know. Like, the city won't know I'm gone. But someone who opens these institutions and has an impact on the culture in the way that you have, but you could go, you're not from here, you could go at any time. I'm wondering what that's like.
One of the best lessons I was given in China was in 2004 when I first landed. Bob in Tangshan, amazing guy, Australian. First week I was here, he looked at me and said, "Butter, you're just arriving. You're going to feel like a star. Nobody's ever seen a foreigner in this town. Everybody's going to do this and this. Do yourself a favor and never buy in your own propaganda." I think with very few exceptions, I've managed to heed that advice and feel fairly ephemeral about all of this.
There will be a point where we're going to have to leave, all of us. Do you feel like that'll be more difficult because of the kind of investments you've made in the community?
I never thought of it as an investment in the community. It's an investment in my own life. I am part of this community. The community doesn't carry the citizenship or the passport. The community is the people that I interact with, and some of them are foreigners, some of them are Chinese. Community is also my staff. They are Chinese. We spend a lot of time with each other. I've already gotten a lot out of it. I've learned a lot of things. I mean, we're not talking about awards. Not that I don't like awards, and I'm so happy to have all of those. But I've got a beautiful life. I've got an amazing wife. I've got some amazing friends. And a community that I care to be part of. Is it going to miss me when I'm gone?
Well, are you going to miss it? You've moved around so much, but you've been here for, like you said, in China, 15 years.
It's the longest I've spent in one single place.
I know.
So there's no way to tell until it happens.
So I'm kind of wondering, at what point are you a migrant when you stop moving, or are you a migrant because you're a foreigner? You know what I mean? You're making me think about that, and I don't know the answer.
You can be a foreigner in your own land.
That's true.
You can be a migrant in your own land. Migration is not just between countries. It's within a country. It's within a community.
We have a lot of that in America.
You used, back in the old days, you were a migrant when you moved to a village that was like 50 miles away from your village. Or half an hour.
This is true.
Already makes you a migrant.
This is true.
I think you really have to think about the concept and how has the concept changed. Are you really a migrant if you're Chinese and you go to the US and you live in Chinatown, where you're basically speaking Chinese, eating Chinese, only dealing with Chinese? Do you have to
look at
the different perspectives of it?
This is making sense.
So migration for me just involves geographic relocation.
Okay.
But does that necessarily have any cultural impact, any personal impact? Most of the time it does. Does it necessarily have it? No. One doesn't go with the other. Like, that's how it's kind of being processed in my own brain.
Yeah. No, you're resonating with what you're saying is resonating with me, because I think about the idea of how we organize ourselves. I talk about this sometimes. As a species, we're tribal species, and we've chosen to organize ourselves under the rubric of what we call nation states. But we started doing that only 400 years ago. Before then, the idea of your quote home or your tribe was smaller city states, you know, maybe some vassal states, you know what I mean? So, you know, the Germanies was not a country. It was a collection of little zones, and Italy was the same thing. And, you know, even Great Britain is a collection of all these little countries, you know, that are mushed together. So the idea of what is my tribe has grown and grown and grown. So the definition of what a migrant is, just like you said, would also grow. And you have to go further to be a migrant, because, you know, you can still be a migrant, but I think how we think about it becomes bigger and bigger because you have to go further and further to feel like you're not in your tribe anymore. It's interesting.
I don't know. You take somebody from Miami, Florida, and you put them in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. It's only about 700 kilometers, and I dare say that they would feel like they're in a completely different tribe.
Well, but
them in Cuba, they might be more at ease. And Cuba is a different country.
Well, that's one of the things that's great about America is that we're really 50 of these vassal states that are mushed together into one big country. Like that's the, you know, internal migration in America is almost as big a deal, I would argue, as moving from country to country. If you go from Massachusetts to Alabama, you're basically in another country. It's so different.
See, now that the more we're talking about it, the more I've more ideas and more things that come to my head. So like looking back at my personal experience, I would say when I lived in the US, I was more of a migrant because I used the same general language as the population around me every day. I worked in it, I communicated in it, I shopped in it, I got entertained in it. I am more of an expat in China because even though I do, to some extent, speak the language to a decent level, I do not use it 100% or even 90% of my time here. I speak English quite often. I speak Chinese quite often. I speak French. I speak Moroccan. And it's rotating between all of these in the same day. So at the end of the day, I think you need to figure out a consensus on how to really define migrant versus expat. And maybe if we go by the dictionary definition, it's just somebody that moves to a different place thinking they might lay roots in it. You're a migrant when you go somewhere maybe and already thinking about a house. You're an expat if you're going somewhere and thinking about savings. I don't
honestly, to be fair, there is no consensus.
Yeah.
You know, one of the conceits of this podcast and the whole migration media project is we're trying to figure this out because in this world, as it's changing, what is a migrant? What is an expat? You know, the technical UN term is international migrant. That's everybody. And then the only category under that that they recognize is refugee because there's a legal definition.
Yep.
Other than that, we're all international migrants, but none of us speak about it that way. So how do we define ourselves? If you're putting down roots, is that change whether you're a migrant or an expat? Like, it's really interesting what you've said, and it's a lot to think about. I don't have the answers, but what I'm hoping is that we can talk about it more. You know, we need as a community to talk about it more. No one goes to your bar and sits down to the guy next to him and says, hey, are you an expat or a migrant? You know, we need to figure this out. And I'm glad that there are people like you who are creating a community where you are because it allows people who are moving from place to place or whether they're there temporarily or semi-permanently or they have no intention to ever leave, it allows people to feel at home because there is a community. And that's really what we're all looking for.
I think, there is something to be said for community always.
Yeah.
That's where you find your comfort zone and your support.
Yeah. Well, Badr, I thank you so much for coming in and blowing my mind a little bit and giving me something to think about. I appreciate your time.
A pleasure. Anytime.
Well, there you have it, folks. Thanks so much to Badr for taking the time to come in and share that story with us. If you're in Beijing, do check out his awesome, awesome restaurant, bar, live house, Caravan. There's a link in the show notes to get you directions. You can check out his menu. It's really amazing food. As always, if you want to reach out to me, you got any questions, you got interview suggestions, you just have topic ideas you'd like me to bring up with guests, you can reach out to me on Twitter at ZAX2000. And of course, email, that's the best, mike.shaw@migrationmedia.net. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week.